This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Yeah, we bring you Thought Council this morning, and we are taking we are looking back in history, back to Libya. Libyans marked their 10th anniversary of the 2011 uprising, and of course, on the 20th of October 2011, Muammar Gaddafi, the longtime ruler of Libya, was killed. Some of you will remember that Gaddafi had come into power after a 1969 coup on King Idris of Libya, who was a political and religious leader there in the United Kingdom of Libya. Suppose that might have inspired Gaddafi on the United States of Africa, and even invited — Gaddafi was quite a colorful person — even invited, you know, traditional leaders from across the continent, and he was knighting himself as almost the emperor of the United States of Africa. Of course, that put him in a collision course with a number of other African leaders. I'm going to be joined on the line by my guest, Dr. Omololu Fagbadebo, who's research associate at the Durban University of Technology. Aisha Kaji is a researcher and independent political analyst, senior fellow at Africa Asia Dialogues. Tembisa Fagude will also be joining us on the line. Omololu, good morning and welcome to Power Talk.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you this morning?
I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Aisha, always a pleasure. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Lukona. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you this morning?
Very good, thank you.
Fantastic. Tembisa, always a pleasure. Budia, good morning to you.
Good morning. Morning, Lukona.
Thank you so much to all of you for making time. Perhaps, Aisha, let me start off with you. I'll give each one of you about, you know, 3 to 4 minutes just to paint your own thoughts on the Libya question. You can take it as pre the uprising, how we got to the uprising, and then, of course, the aftermath. Long after Gaddafi had been killed, of course, there had been attempts on his life, or at least moves or attempts to try and get rid of him as the leader of Libya, especially in the 80s. You can really approach the conversation and give us your core thoughts before we probably tease out some of the themes and look at 10 years since the killing of Gaddafi. Has it really yielded any fruits? Aisha, I'll start off with you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, as I think most of your listeners probably know, Muammar Gaddafi, Colonel Gaddafi, as he styled himself, was leader of Libya since the 1969 coup until his death in 2011, his very grisly, publicly paraded death, with the help of NATO forces and particularly U.S. airstrikes. He began, his career as a leader in a style that many consider exemplary today, because his very real concern at the time was the upliftment of the Libyan people. He was also vociferously opposed to imperialism, and was the first leader of a developing country to actually demand a share of the revenues, a good share of the revenues from his country's resources. In this case, of course, Libya is very rich in oil. And while the foreign companies that had previously been looting both Libya and other parts of the continent, other parts of the developing South, were very taken aback by this, he was adamant that, the resources of his country should not be used to enrich others primarily, but to enrich Libyans. And to a large extent, he achieved that goal. You know, he did some really wonderful things in terms of socioeconomics. He achieved free universal education for all, insisted that primary education, at the very least, should be open to both genders, And so, you know, quite surprisingly for somebody who considered himself a Muslim, an Arab, an African, and with the prevailing cultures of those three identities at the time, he was very pro women's rights, etc. He also ensured that medical facilities were available to all at no cost. He didn't completely ensure, even at the time of his death, that housing, free housing was available to all, or that some housing was available to all, but that was another of his aims. Mm. And at one stage, Libya had one of the highest per capita incomes in Africa. You know, so he actually did provide a lot of what he promised. Yes, there was also, particularly in the second half of his rule, the second two decades of his rule, if you will, there was also a history of repression, of unevenness, of corruption at the highest levels of government, etc. But his vision for Libya and indeed for the peoples of Africa, outlined in his famous three-volume Green Book, was in and of itself a political vision that actually did have legs. Unfortunately, it got hijacked, and it got hijacked largely by greed, as we've seen so often elsewhere on the continent. But, you know, I think he, particularly in up until the early 80s, had, while he was certainly eccentric, he had a reputation in the West. You know, they called him the Mad Dog of Africa, the Mad Dog of Libya, etc. That reputation was, to some extent, I would say, unwarranted. He began to live up to it more and more. And of course, you know, Libya was condemned for the bombing of a Berlin nightclub in 1986. And then, of course, the infamous Lockerbie bombing in Scotland in 1988, which really turned the tide of Western sentiment against him very strongly. And it was only in the mid-1990s with the intercession of our own former president, Mr. Mandela, that Mr. Gaddafi agreed to hand over the suspects in that Lockerbie bombing, and then became, you know, then came a detente for Libya with the West. Okay. To some extent.
Aisha, let's hold the thought there. Let me bring in Dr. Fagbadebo just to share his opening remarks.
Thank you, Likon. Thank you, Aisha, for that precise description of Gaddafi's Libya. Gaddafi came as a safe, you know, when it began his leadership in Libya. He came as someone that was celebrated because he took Libya from where it was to a new pedestal in global politics. And he did well by concentrating on the domestic affair. He was able to develop the state, develop the people, and he established himself in the hearts of the people. And that's why he said some time ago that, look, every Libyan is a Gaddafi. That is the essence of the loyalty because of good governance that he epitomized in the early days of his leadership. Mm. And that was a very good one because it was like a revolution in governance in Africa at that time. That hardly can you see in those days when military regime was a fashion. No, can you see military leaders who come out and then establish good governance, make, you know, social activities, social services available for citizens, judicious use of national resources. And so that endeared him to the heart of an average Libyan. And that is why I was able to say that, look, killing me does not mean that you kill my dream. Killing me means that every other Gaddafi will rise. I've trained them to that level. But his greatest undoing was to have put his heart into the crisis in the international system. I think that was his greatest undoing. Mm. And it was like what I said, as I said, it was born out of greed and ambition. Ambition, yes, the African project, United African project, it was a good idea, but what was the motive behind that project? you are in the international system where power defines interest. And you are dealing with powerful people, hegemonic states. If you want to contest with them, don't contest with them with crisis. Contest with them with thought, you've been doing something good. You didn't depend on foreign power for your economy. You have a good economy. So why don't you spread that and let it be a kind of a legacy? For the bombing, the Lockerbie bombing in 1988 actually put him on the spot to the extent that great powers via the United Nations had to place sanctions on Libya. And that was the beginning of the crisis in Libya at that time. And later degeneration of his style with repression, silencing opposition. Well, one cannot rule out the fact that foreign powers intervene, you know, had a way of, because when, for example, America, if America wants to deal with you, he knows how to raise up insurrection from within. But I think he was left off his guard. He didn't take note of that. He just went head on collision with the foreign powers. And that is what the greatest undoing is, greed. You know, and then the movement towards a kind of hereditary leadership, whereby is preparing his children to take over. Okay. And in the process, the children became albatross to him.
Okay.
The actions of the children became albatross. I think
let's hold that thought there, Omololu. We will continue with this conversation. Temisa, let me just pay some bills, and then I'll give you a chance as well to have your share in terms of, you know, how you perceive this. People of Power, this is Thought Council. We are looking 10 years on since the killing of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Have we rethought, have we reimagined some of the questions that were hanging around that time, 10 years on, and what we see in Libya today? 22 minutes past 10.
Power Talk on Power 98.7.
Indeed, it is 25 minutes past 10. 10 years since the killing of Muammar Gaddafi in what was a coordinated effort between protesters and NATO, and led, of course, by the United States of America. Temisa Fagude is one of my three guests this morning. I'll give him a chance to state, you know, his thoughts as well as we lead towards Power News headlines. Temisa?
Yes, Lukona. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to disappoint my two guests.
Yeah.
in trying to whitewash the contribution in the history of Muammar Gaddafi. I had the pleasure of spending a lot of time in Libya, and one of my journalists, while I was still the bureau chief of Al Jazeera Media Network in Southern Africa, Mohammed Din Al-Fal, was arrested and tortured in Libya, leading to the toppling of Muammar Gaddafi. The fact that the people of Libya rose against Muammar Gaddafi should tell you something. I mean, for us to continue saying that the toppling of Muammar Gaddafi was led by the protesters at NATO is not true. It was the Libyans who led the protest against Muammar Gaddafi. I have friends who have been lingering in jail in Libya. Some of them have been exiled. And I never understood this, of course, as a South African, because Muammar Gaddafi, true, he was quite good and generous to us as South Africans. I happened to be at some stage part of the executive council or committee of the Muslim Youth Movement in South Africa, and he was very helpful towards us achieving our goals. And he helped quite a number of people, including Winnie Mandela building her house in Soweto and the ANC, etc. But when I moved and I stayed in the Arab world, and I got a chance to interact with a number of Libyans, very progressive on all sides of the political spectrum, right and left, every single one of them condemned Muammar Gaddafi. I had friends and their parents who were executed, exiled, and killed by Muammar Gaddafi. He was a dictator. He was good and kind to people outside Libya, but I'm not quite sure whether when you go to Libya, you'll find the same kind of sentiment dominating different spheres of the civil society. The other thing, by the way, which is important, that decision that was made, amongst others, with South Africa flip-flopping when the NATO forces led by Italy, Britain, and others eventually going into Libya. South Africa was part and parcel of it. If you go to the Middle East and in Libya, the Libyans were extremely upset by the decision. They didn't expect South Africa, a country with such a progressive history, that they would have been part and parcel of not supporting wholeheartedly the decision of the assistance which was required and expected by the Libyan people. So for anyone who will come and say that Muammar Gaddafi was a great guy, a revolutionary who pushed a certain agenda for the Libyan people, is not really true. And this is evident for some of us who've worked in that part of the world, who've interacted with different people from different political spectrum of Libya. They will tell you that the man was a dictator. And it's not only in Libya. If you go to some of his platforms, particularly the Arab League, on things that he used to say and do to other countries in the Middle East, he was very close with for example, Saddam Hussein. And he was close with all other dictators that we now know in the Middle East who were toppled after the 2011 Arab Spring. The fact that there was Arab Spring and it happened in Libya, it would be unfair and not just for me to be saying that those people did not have legitimate concerns. They were somehow misled by NATO and America into toppling Muammar Gaddafi. He was a dictator. He oppressed his people and he killed his people.
Got you, Thembisa, loud and clear. Aisha and Omolulu, I'll give you a chance to also, you know, respond. But people of power, let me give you the opportunity to dial in on 0861-987-000 and be in conversation with my guest, Thembisa Fakude, Senior Fellow at Africa-Asia Dialogue, Dr. Omolulu Fagbadebo, Research Associate at the Durban University of Technology, Aisha Kaji, Researcher and Independent Political Analyst joining us this morning on this Thought Council, where we are looking at 10 years since the death of Muammar Gaddafi, one legacy that remains, as you hear, highly contested in many ways. We will also delve into the aftermath, what has been happening in Libya in the past 10 years, and what can be done to reconstitute that country, but to take that country into a place of development and respect for human rights. I mean, you would have heard a few weeks ago, we had a chat here on Libya and the developments that are happening there with heavy-handed force being used by the state in some instances to search and detain some people. Well, 0861-987-000. Katlego, I see you are good and ready, bright and ever so gentlemanly you are this morning.
Thought Council.
24 minutes to the hour, 11 o'clock. Let's run back into it. I've got my guests, Aisha Kaji, Dr. Omololu Fagbadebo, and Thembisa Fakude being my guest this morning. 0861-987-000 is the dial for you this morning. And we keep on talking. 10 years since the killing of Muammar Gaddafi. Aisha, when you've listened to some of the colleagues on the line, I suppose one of the key issues to really deal with that I wanted to ask about, and I mean, Constitution on Twitter raises this, saying that Muammar Gaddafi was an overrated dictator, and the international community couldn't keep quiet and really had to do something, and says Rwandanese people will one day revolt against Kagame. I suppose, I mean, you did allude, you know, to those socioeconomic interventions. They were confirmed by the Human Development Index itself at some point, Libya being the highest ranked country in the HDI. But this idea of development in a place that does not allow for people's freedom to thrive, what problem does it create for a country?
Well, many problems, really, because if people's voices are not heard and are actively suppressed, as was the case in Libya. And by the way, Thembisa, I'm not for one moment suggesting that Gaddafi was not a dictator. Certainly the second 20 years of his rule, he was very, very authoritarian, very dictatorial, and clamped down and very repressive on his own people, while being, as Thembisa has said, very generous to those outside. With the fact that freedom of expression was severely limited in Libya, and giving total, you know, consideration to the fact that Mr. Gaddafi was a dictator. Still, it could be argued that perhaps he would not have been toppled without the NATO intervention. Certainly, there have been various, very serious military and political studies done on this question in the last 10 years that seem to point in that direction. However, yes, there was a general uprising by the Libyans, largely against the repression of voice, the lack of freedom of expression, the authoritarian nature of the government, the uneven development in the country where, for example, certain areas of the country were prioritized because they were seen as being Gaddafi's strongholds in relation to others, etc. So there was all of that problem. However, since the toppling of Gaddafi without, I might add, a reasonable political alternative in place, because at the time there was a group of loosely defined militias and civilian uprisings, but there was no move towards a concerted unity government. And one of the things that Mr. Gaddafi did manage, to his credit, was to keep the very disparate tribes of Libya under nominal control, at least, which has not been the case in the last 10 years. So in the last 10 years, we've seen a series of civilian military uprisings or military-backed uprisings in various parts of the country. We've seen civil war, really, you know, both in the south and the north of the country. We've seen the danger of so-called Islamist groups taking over parts of the country, as happened in 2015 with ISIS in insert. And we've seen also particularly the interference of geopolitical interests in the country on different sides of the divide. So up until very recently, there was a government of so-called national accord on the one hand in Benghazi and Tripoli, and then there was this so-called LNA also controlling large swathes of the country and to some extent in opposition with each other. There have been peace talks recently. There is a move towards, and I say a move towards because I don't think it is yet a government of national unity. There are elections scheduled for November this year and early next year. So the presidential elections first and then the legislative elections. Finally, there is some move towards what we see outside of Libya as a democratic process culminating in elections.
Okay.
But whether that is actually going to bring stability to the country, peace to the country, is very, very questionable. Currently, Libya is a center of smuggling, people smuggling, oil smuggling, other types of trafficking. It is also a place where people are desperate, so desperate that people on the ground who previously opposed Gaddafi now say they would welcome him back. So what does that say to Tembisa's narrative of authoritarianism and dictatorship, which I do agree with, but there is such a lack of stability right now, such a war weariness amongst Libyans, and such a huge decline in their standard in the standard of living of most Libyans on the ground. What does that say about the way that intervention was done in 2011 and its aftermath for the past decade?
Aisha, let me bring Omololu back onto this conversation. Omololu, I mean, Libya was always said to be a very delicate country because of its diversity, lot of ethnic groups as well that, you know, trying to put together through a political system. Gaddafi would try and push back and say, but yeah, there are elections at local levels, even if he might remain the supreme ruler, quote unquote, of the country. How do you feel that, you know, the lack of democratization after he had taken over in 1969 actually led to what we have today? Because some of these are outcomes of seeds that may have been planted years ago.
Thank you, Ilguna, and thank you, Aisha, and the other panelists. Yes, if you understand the way Gaddafi came into power, like every other African country, we have military rule. We have military rule. Military rule, they abhorred democratization. And by the way, Libya has never enjoyed a democratic process.
Mm.
When he took over in 1969, he deposed King Idris. and he came back. When he came, he banned all political parties, turned it to rule by the people. Well, that is a way of benevolent dictator we operate. But one thing we cannot take away from Libya, from Gaddafi, was that Gaddafi's Libya was still stable in terms of human development. The greatest undoing, like I said earlier, was because of his own ambition and greed, and that's what consumed him. And the fact that, yes, Libya is a multi-ethnic nation, but this crisis did not manifest the way it is being manifested now during Gaddafi. Apparently, maybe he knew what could be if there was democracy, he might likely lose his power, and then so he didn't want to lose power. So that was why he didn't, establish maybe democratic culture in Libya at that time. Like what I guess was that he was trying to establish a system like his compatriot in Uganda when he first came, and then there was no political parties after he came from the bush, and it's ruled by the people. That is a style of dictators, and most of the time, like what happened to Gaddafi, he was consumed by his own ambition and greed. So there's no doubt about that he was repressive. There's no doubt that he was authoritarian. But the only thing we need to understand is that he had a bit of understanding of the Libyan political system and environment. And then he tried as much as possible to enforce his own rulership through good governance, at least up to an extent. Yes, people may not, domestically, they may not like him. They may not like him. But then you cannot rule out the fact that he contributed a lot to human development in Libya during his time. And we can see that happening now, because we can compare Libya, Gaddafi's Libya, with post-Gaddafi Libya. We can see the difference, that after the killing of Gaddafi 10 years ago, Gaddafi has said Libya has never remained the same. Yes, democracy was destroyed. Why? Because the culture of democracy was never in Libya.
Okay, let me come back to Tembisa. Tembisa, I mean, you've heard the colleagues and, pointing out to even the instruments, as I said earlier, of the Human Development Index. But you are probably still going to say, look, as much as that may have been happening, people were talking about, other socioeconomic entitlements that citizens would have, healthcare, water system in the middle of a desert that at least made sure that people were looked after. So there were development touch points, but you are probably saying, and I wanted to give a response before I go to Robert, Prince and Michael on the line, I do see them, but you are probably going to say, well, while that might have existed, the reality of his tyranny is probably what brought us to where we are today.
That's correct, and that's commonplace or aftermath of any revolution. There are a lot of people in South Africa who will tell you that they wish apartheid could return because things were better. So post the assumption of governance by the ANC, they feel that they're now so changed. So it is expected. But Gaddafi was a tribalist. He was extremely toxic to regional politics, including the politics, for example, of Uganda. His close relationship with Yoweri Museveni, one of the long-serving dictators in Africa, is problematic. He's been pushing money there through Islamic Cult Society, amongst other organizations. He was very close to Idris Deby of Chad, and propping up all other dictators around Libya. Small countries like Niger, for example, were getting money from Gaddafi to continue oppressing his own people. So the aftermath of the Arab Spring is almost the same everywhere. You look in Syria, it's the same thing. If you want to look at now in Tunisia, they're going through the same situation. If you look at Yemen, for example, they're going through the same situation. So it was expected that after this revolution, after such a long time of domination of politics by these dictators in the Middle East, including Gaddafi, the situation was definitely not going to be the same as it was before. I mean, the Iraqis, for example, If you go to some places in Baghdad, they will tell you how grand times were during the times of Saddam Hussein. But he was a dictator. He killed his own people, jailed his own people, and exiled millions of Iraqis who now found in different parts of the Gulf. So, unfortunately, I don't have anything great to say about Muammar al-Gaddafi, except that, yes, it did assist us as South Africans and other African countries in towards the liberation and in fighting oppression in different parts of, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. But you won't find similar sentiments in Libya, nor will you find similar sentiments in other parts of the Arab world, in countries like Egypt or the Gulf. I'm not saying they are more democratic, but they've got stories to tell about the atrocities of Muammar al-Gaddafi and what he has done to his people. Yes, indeed, he pushed also tribalism. If you look at the emergence of strong tribalism in Libya right now, you have different tribes suddenly wanting also to occupy a place of power. And all of this was encouraged by Muammar Gaddafi using his people and other people in Misrata, for example, where he continued to encourage tribalism. So he has not been very constructive inside Libya. I think outside Libya has done very well. But inside Libya and the Libyans, they don't have the similar stories of celebration that we have as outsiders who were benefiting from Muammar al-Gaddafi.
Got you loud and clear, Thembisa. Robert, let me take you out of your weight. I'm so sorry. Good morning.
Good morning, Nkona, and thanks for bringing such a rich panel, people like Thembisa who have been to Libya during Gaddafi's days. But I just want to say, Nkona, that, you know, I just find that sometimes times as South Africans, we are so secure in our own comfort that it's easy for us to dismiss the sufferings of other people. Gaddafi was a brutal dictator. There's no other way of putting it. I hear one of your panelists there saying that, look, this guy was great because he kept the tribal chiefs together and all those kind of things. Well, those things work on the basis of patronage because he was giving them money. But if you went and spoke to the people on the ground, you would have found out exactly how they were suffering. People were put to jail without any genuine trials or fair trials. They were killed in prison. So Gaddafi was brutal. It's happening in Swaziland. It's happening in Zimbabwe. You were talking about Rwanda earlier. So if you look at countries like Rwanda and you want to conclude that, look, the country is good because Kagame is great, look, it's a ticking time bomb. One day we could wake up and the whole country is on flames because he's oppressing people.
Mm. Okay. Robert, got you. Let me go to Prince. Prince, good morning. Please, Prince, I've got echo from you. Can you switch off?
You know, what I wanted to talk, the lady has just spoken about it, but I wanted to talk to something about Ubaba Thembisa. Ubaba Thembisa, there's something that you are living, the one puzzle that you are living, the West. The West, they are the all causes of that thing, that Libya now is on, I don't know what can I say, how they are living now. It's all about West because they are protecting the oil.
So how has the West caused, or what has the West caused, Prince, perhaps?
The West, they are the one who made that problem to be like that because they wanted the oil from that place. They wanted to control the oil. And they are still controlling that oil. They are still protecting the oil. They are not protecting the Libyans. That's what I can say. It was the lady has taken everything that I wanted to talk about.
Okay, got you loud and clear, Prince. Michael, good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
I'm attending.
I wanted to find out, because at the time of the killing of Gaddafi, America and France, the United, for that joint operation to take place. And South Africa at the time was having a seat in the UN Security Council.
Yes.
And according to my understanding, this could not have happened without South Africa approval, because South Africa was representing Africa then. So would that then be correct to say Africa then was involved to destroy one of their most prominent father, you know?
Okay.
And then what are the dynamics within the Security Council in terms of power?
Okay, Michael, I got you. I'll put those questions to my guests. 0861-987-000 is the dial. Let's pay some bills and continue this conversation.
Power Talk, 9 a.m. to noon.
It is 6 minutes to the hour, 11 o'clock. I'll give my guests just to reflect on some of those questions. Of course, that issue, and I do want all of you to probably say, is the jury still out on the United Nations Security Council in terms of the role that they played back then with that very contested resolution 1973, which visited upon airstrikes, perhaps also just as a way of concluding our conversation. Aisha, I'll start off with you.
Sure. I think that there's definitely a need, as we've been calling for more than a decade now, for a re-look at how the United Nations Security Council is comprised, how it goes about making its decisions, etc. 1973 was a very contentious resolution, particularly as some of the U.S. airstrikes preceded it. So it wasn't, that was a unilateral decision in some respects by the U.S. And it was then kind of whitewashed, I would say, by the U.N. Security Council resolution. So I think there's a definite need for reform of the Security Council. However, until and unless that happens, the U.N. Security Council and the U.N. in general, the organization in general, with respect to Libya, should be looking at the geopolitical aspects of other countries' current involvement in the Libyan crisis. So, for example, those countries such as Sisi's Egypt, such as the United Arab Emirates, such as Russia, such as Turkey, their involvement in the Libyan conflict and their active support, including military and financial support for the two main factions, I'll loosely call them the GNA and the LNA, even though they're now supposed to be part of a government of national unity. We all know that unity is very much a shallow thing right now. And the interference of outside states in that process, they would perhaps hesitate to call it interference. They might call it support. Some might call it support for democracy. But at the same time, that is something that the UN does have a responsibility to oversee, and particularly in view of its commitment to a responsibility to protect civilians, which is not coming out in this geopolitical shilly-shallying, I'll call it, on Libya by various countries. And as I said, up to and including not just financial support, but also military support, which at the end of the day, the only casualties, the real casualties, are civilians on the ground. And of course, the other fallout is the economic casualties, which have been ongoing in Libya. Also, just to point out that since 2011, the repression of freedom of expression has become even more severe. 2 years ago, the GNA passed a decree, I think it's called 280-something, I can't remember exactly the wording of it, but really that had, echoes of the Gaddafi era of repression, and in fact, even worse. And since then, journalists, human rights activists, lawyers, migrants, immigrants, women have largely been targeted by the state. Any dissent has been met with a crackdown.
Okay.
So,
Aisha, let's hold there. Let me give Omololu a chance also to have a view. Omololu, please go ahead.
Thank you. I hear one of the callers talking about the influence of the West, in Libyan crisis. Yes, we cannot rule it out. Like as I just said, what prompted the UN and NATO to intervene was because of the concept of responsibility to protect. Because at that time, the civilians were suffering. And when two elephants fight, the grass will suffer. So, yes, it was true that the West, they had interest in Libyan oil, not only in Libya, in the Middle East generally, and not only in the Middle East, all other developing countries that have resources that are in the interest. Remember, I said earlier,
that when you are talking in terms of international politics, you are talking in terms of power defined by interest. So everyone is looking for his interest. But then, for Libya to have, like I said, Gaddafi played into the hand of the West. And so that was the greatest undoing. And then now that the whole thing has crumbled, now you see the civilians are left to lick their wounds. I don't know when Libya will come to normal with the kind of division that is in Libya right now and different interests in the global system pitching their tent behind the various groups that are emanating. I wouldn't be surprised if Libya becomes a divided nation in the near future with what is going on, because the polarization is so acute that to reach a compromise, to reach a possible peace, even with election coming, will be made a little bit difficult.
Okay, Omololu, thank you. Butemisa, let me give you a minute to wrap up as well, please.
Well, I think we are over exaggerating the influence of NATO and the Americans in the politics that led to the toppling of Muammar Gaddafi. The Arab Spring was a homegrown revolution. It started in Tunisia, it went on to Egypt and in Libya. The people of Libya rose against Muammar Gaddafi. It had nothing to do with NATO and the US at the time. Yes, they came later on to take advantage. That's the first point. It was a homegrown revolution led by the Libyans because of the oppression of Muammar Gaddafi. And that has to be emphasized. It was the people of Libya who toppled Muammar Gaddafi. In fact, the pictures when Muammar Gaddafi was pulled out from that hole, a shot was taken by a South African. Very few people know that. It was a cameraman from South Africa who took that shot. He used to work for Al Jazeera. That's the first point. The other point, I do agree with the external factor, the external actors who are now involved in Libya, particularly propping up and encouraging people like Khalifa al-Haftar, who has been toxic to the politics of Libya. And one particular candidate has been doing that, led by Mohammed bin Zayed, is the United Arab Emirates that has been now creating and continuing to cause havoc inside Libya. But, this easy, convenient excuse of all the time blaming the Western powers and NATO and America in whatever's happening in the Middle East and Africa, we need sometimes to do a little bit of work into looking at why people revolt. Okay. And in Libya, it was the Libyans.
Okay. Tembisa, Omololu, Aisha, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.